My name's Catherine Beattie. I'm a senior social worker. I work for Devon County Council in West Devon. We've got a mixed population of people, lots of sort of rural poverty issues, and then lots of people who perhaps have retired to the West Country because it's lovely and it's a really green spot. And then they've become sort of much, much older and frailer, and are in isolated spots that perhaps in their 60s seem lovely, but in their 80s are beginning to be a bit scary for them. I knew at 18 I wanted to be a social worker. I knew, and I felt very sure about that. When I think back, I was at primary school and all of my friends needed support. I was someone who's naturally drawn to people that I thought needed help. I probably was a mini social worker at the age of 5, probably. My mum was a social worker, so part of the reason I don't have as many friendships now where I feel I'm kind of rescuing people is because I watched mum do it. She gave so much of herself, it affected her health. And the sad thing for me is that we'd spent lots of years saying, "Mum, you know, make time for yourself and please relax and, you know, do things for you." And one of the things I've grappled with a lot probably since she died is how do I be a really good empathic person but keep myself well, you know, because you can burn out so easily. Our retirement age, my retirement age is 68. So the one thing I'm thinking is if I have to wait till then, can I do that? Can I sustain this till then? We talk about it here and wonder. And I've got friends that have stayed in social work well into their 60s and been brilliant. And I think, how have they done that? I work with a lot of people in the past who, with between their 40s and 50s, were burning out and really cynical, shouldn't be there. I had a couple of friends who burnt out really badly. And I worked with someone who committed suicide. And then I had someone close to me who burnt out and had a breakdown, really, and had to sort of stop work for quite a chunk of time. There's some really good research by someone called Christina Maslach, and she talks about the fact that if you're not careful and you don't get the work-life balance right and you're not resilient enough, people can get something called compassion fatigue. So it begins with, I'm with someone, they're telling me something awful, and it doesn't touch me in any way, shape or form, and that's a clue that something's not quite right because we're not having an emotional response at all. And I felt it myself in parts of my probation career. I remember sitting thinking, I've heard this so many times before and I don't care anymore. It was that kind of situation. And each time I felt it, I was exhausted and I would leave that particular post, move into a different branch of the service and have almost like this energy revival. So yeah, lots of the day I'm sitting on a computer. They didn't have computers when I first qualified, so this is the building, really. I'm in my later 40s and I've been doing this sort of 22 years, and I feel at this point I've got a good work-life balance. I love my job, I really love my job, and when I'm here I give it 110% and I'm really passionate about what I do. And I know that I take that home. So I know that, you know, I can't pretend that I've got a magic button that I press when I walk out of the office. So some nights, the way I would say I take it home is that I'm mentally exhausted. And I'm quite a serious person. And I think, was I serious before I became a social worker? Or has social work made me serious? You're working with people in distress the whole time. This team here is an NHS team and they're the intermediate care therapy team, so they do all the emergency responses if someone has a fall or is in crisis. So they go out first, and then if they identify that someone needs a social worker, they come back to us and we step in. When I was first here, I had a case where everyone in the team had worked with this person, and she was a really chronic drinker. And the first thing that happened was the care agency said to me, "We're pulling out, we can't go in anymore," because she was drinking and soiling herself and everything was just horrendous in her house. And they were going in, finding her covered in sort of faeces and a bed was soaked. So we actually had to make a decision as a team that with no agencies prepared to go in, because none of them would go in, we had to leave her for a bit and see what happened. And what that really meant was that we kept in touch and I'd pop out and see her, but it was dire. And then she fell down the stairs, broke her neck, but survived. And we started this journey together where she was discharged from hospital into a home, because if she moved her head, she'd die or become paralysed. And was there for a bit, started drinking again, then stopped, and then said to me, take me home. And on the way home, she said, can we stop for a newspaper? And I said, yep, fine, like a fool. And she went into the shop and came out, and I could hear clanking, this bag clanking. And I said to her, do you want to talk to me about anything? No, no, I'm fine. Please talk to me, because I think you've bought alcohol. No, I haven't. No, I haven't. Took her home. Please talk to me. Please talk to me. No, no, I'm fine. Just go. So relapsed again. And again, it was really, really bad. Each time she went to rock bottom, I'd think, can you go any lower than that in terms of how she felt? And I think there was a time when I thought, I think I'm getting too emotionally affected by this, because I was really like beside myself, because I'd go home thinking she's going to die. And I didn't miss the fact that she and my mum would have been the same age and she had a daughter. So I don't know, I have very big ups and downs, I think, with all of it. Days when you think, oh, it's so bleak, and then days where a human thing happens and you think that's really lovely. I've had people on my caseload who've been fighter pilots in the war, land girls, some of them been in domestic service, some of them have been prisoners of war, some of them have just stayed at home and had their babies. But the group of people I work with, it just feels like an honour, really. They're interesting. They're not just going to listen to everything you say and agree with you. You have a debate with them about stuff. And I love the team, because it's the kindest, nicest, most generous team I've ever worked in. It's a team of real individuals. They've all got hobbies. They've all got a life outside work. You know, they go home and do other things. But we come in, and when we're here, we're really focused and we care. When I first qualified, people would come to the office as much as I went to them. Nowadays, receptions have been closed and buildings are closed, and the work happens in the person's home. And the frontline queries about things that perhaps years ago people would just drop in, they have to now ring a call centre, which is the face of modern social work, really, or social care. So, hi, Jamie. Social care has always been under-resourced, and we are in a situation now where we're more and more having to say to someone, I'm really sorry, I can't get you the care. I'm really sorry, but the home that you want is full and we've got to send your mum or dad 50 miles away. I'm really sorry, but your mother or father's got to stay in hospital because we can't find them anywhere. So there's much more tension, a lot more discussions about money as well, lots of battles with families about the cost of care. For example, at 3:30 yesterday, we got notice from a local home. It's a private provider, chap that's been up with them for a couple of weeks, who's not settling. They'd served notice and said to us, you have to take this man away by tomorrow morning. And the truth is, we've got nowhere to take him at all. We've got nowhere. There aren't any mental health beds. There aren't any other homes with immediate beds. And it's really sensitive. And on top of that, he's got a daughter that's beside herself, you know. So we're reliant on the private sector who can at a whim say, right, get this person out. We don't want them anymore. And it's really, really difficult. So we were ringing round at 3:30, frantically trying to find other homes that were willing to support him to go. All of them were full. So then we found one that said, yeah, we have got a vacancy, ring us back tomorrow, we can't tell you anything till tomorrow. So we rang back and the home said, well, actually, we have got a vacancy, but not for him. And if he did come, we want £1,000 a week to take him. Very few homes in the private sector are going to say, yes, we'll take someone who's really challenging. Yes, we'll take him tomorrow morning. So there's a really sort of wobbly period where you're trying to make a referral that's honest, whilst also remembering we're talking about a person, you know, who's got needs, who's not all bad. And actually, he's not bad at all, but, you know, he isn't going to be straightforward. But sometimes when it's bleakest and darkest, you'll find a bit of compassion in the service. So, for example, this chap that's in a really dire situation, who's got a home that's being very business-led. He's a nuisance, get him out. The home that's actually we finally found that said they'd come and see him said, oh, it sounds like, you know, he needs a bit of support to settle. And yeah, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Who've got a much more compassionate view of him as a human being. And if that works, I think that will make me feel a lot better, because there's still that sort of hope. Thank you.